We called this class, Aliza and I, Lessons from the Imahot. And I think you'll find it interesting. I had fun doing it, and hopefully you'll learn something. I know that you're all at home with your kids now. I just got a call from Rachel. I think everybody's getting a little nuts. And maybe this will help you a little bit. All right. So let me just give you my formal introduction, and that is right now we are in the Shloshes Yimei Hagbalah, close to Shavuos. And I know all of you, and I know you're all committed to Torah and the performance of mitzvahs. But I think that all of us are not just concerned with our own perfection. As mothers, we have that additional challenge. We are our children's primary teachers, and we want to guide them and raise them in a healthy environment. We want them to experience the love of Torah and mitzvahs and a joy in their performance. Now, as women over the years, we've fought very hard for equality. And if we just look around at the women in the yeshiva, I think that there's an amazing amount of intellectual, intelligent, productive women. We have doctors, we have PAs, we have nurses, we have lawyers, we have entrepreneurs and engineers and therapists and CEOs and biologists, PhDs, computer people, mathematicians, teachers, but mostly we have mothers. And to reach these goals, we've put in a lot of time, a lot of energy. We've gone through a lot of schooling, papers, tests, and we've been able to accomplish it all. But that doesn't seem to be enough for us as women, because we really want to find the man of our dreams, we want to get married, and we want to have children. And really, it's not Rookie Dreyer who gave us this prototype, but way back it was Dvorah. The Pasuk says, Ad Shekamti Dvorah, Ad Shekamti Aim B'Yisrael, that Dvorah was the woman who, not only was she a mother, but she was a government official. She was able to judge, and she had nevuah. And so that it's possible. We can become highly educated, and we can become amazing mothers. Now, I have a practice. When somebody in the yeshiva has a baby, I wait a couple of days till she gets home, and I call to wish her mazel tov. And inevitably, when I call these women, I get somebody who is totally exhausted, in a mild state of shock, trying to keep it together, and they can't imagine how a 7-pound baby could have turned their lives upside down. These are women who have gone through, they can suture, they can sew, they can teach. They can ace a test, but give them a newborn, and they are just, they don't know what to do. This kid doesn't stop crying, doesn't know the difference between day and night, and they just, it's just funny, but everybody seems to react like they don't know how did this happen to them. But you know what? Eventually, the tired brains kick in, and we begin to function, and now the job begins. As an aim B'Yisrael, it's your awesome responsibility to nurture the child, to educate the child, and to raise him. As a mother and a grandmother and a great-grandmother, I take a personal interest in raising children. I was a teacher. I was always involved with children. And I don't know, one day I just decided that I wanted to look through the Tanakh and see what I could learn from the Imahot. What lessons, what challenges did they face? How did they relate to their kids? And what can we learn in a practical way from them? But please, I just want you to know, and I have to say it from the outset, I took the facts. I sometimes ran them by my husband. I had the thought, and I would not say that. It was just the facts that I used, and my knowledge of children and how we raise them to see what I could take. Okay. So I almost changed my mind because Chava raised a child who murdered somebody. I thought, okay, I don't know if this is going to be a good project, but okay, I will persevere. So I started with Chava, and at the beginning of Bereshit, it tells us, Zachor v'nekeva b'ra'am. God created a man and a woman. Then later on it says that they were Ish v'Isha. That is when the relationship began between Adam and Chava, when he realized she was Etzamei Atzamei, she was an Ezer Kenegdo. That's the relationship part. Then it was up to Adam to categorize all of the species, and he called his wife, Vayikra Adam, as Shem Ishtel Chava. Ki hi haisa em kolchai. So he understood that that is what Chava was built to do. She would, in the future, this described what would happen in the future, she was going to be able to give birth to children, and she was, in fact, the mother of all living beings. Okay. Now, when she gave birth to Cain, it's interesting. She gave him the name Cain, and I know that from all my years of hearing, you know, mothers call if children are born, giving your child a name is a very big deal. Sometimes you're just locked in. You have a family name and you have no choice. But there are other times there are heroes for you, people that you want your children to grow up to be. And so when she called him Cain, the pasuk says, Kanisi Ish Es Hashem. And there are two things that we learn from the pasuk. The first is the word Ish Es Hashem. In the beginning, Hashem created Adam and Chava. With the birth of Cain, we have that concept that God partners with us in the creation of a child. Habei Esavicha V'Esimecha. Kanisi Ish Es Hashem. However, the name that she gave her son is really amazing because Cain comes from Kinyan. When you make a Kinyan, you take ownership of something. So that gives you pause and you think to yourself, wait a second, does the name Cain reflect how she looked at her child? Was she a possessive mother? Was she the first Jewish possessive mother? Do you know, it's amazing to me that when you go on this website, Old Jewish Men Telling Jokes, there's no end to the jokes of possessive, controlling mothers. And I have to tell you one joke. What's the difference between a Jewish mother and a pit bull? Eventually the pit bull lets go. So this is kind of an amazing thing. So I looked at the idea of what is a possessive mother. And a possessive mother, possessiveness is a form of personal control. It's an unverbalized feeling, you're mine and nobody else's. The possessive mother is thinking only of her own needs for her continued attachment to that child. But what happens to the child is kind of sad because he might lack friends. He has that smothering mother. He may not be able to express an opinion. He doesn't get an opinion in that house. And he may become a passive aggressive because he has no outlet for his feelings. A weak person, someone who's fearful of confrontation and has difficulties in his relationships. So Cain might have taken on the personality of his mother, what he learned from his mother. And that may have shaped his nature. And now perhaps you can understand his relationship with his brother. As soon as it became adversarial, as soon as there was a conflict in the relationship, it was just something he could not handle. He couldn't fight back. He couldn't verbalize how he felt. And he was able to get rid of his brother. There was no room for his brother in his world. Now, I am just saying, I'm taking this idea simply from the fact that she gave him a name which represented how she might have raised him by controlling him and possessing him and feeling that sense of ownership. And To me, I think that firstly, a person has to understand your child is not an extension of yourself. He's a child. He's a human being. He has his own personality. He has his own needs. And frankly, I think you have no right to own anybody. And the repercussions from raising a child like that, as you see, can sometimes take on serious consequences. And please feel free if anybody has anything they want to contribute. I'm more than happy to hear what you have to say. So that was the first one. I guess we could call Chava a controlling mother. And there are many of them out there. Okay. In contrast to that, I would call Sarah the protector. Sarah is a totally different situation. I think what Sarah faced is something that we face a lot today with our children. She was childless until she was 90 years old and was in disbelief when she was told that she would be able to have a child. She had already given Hagar to Abraham. She had hoped that she would build from her, that there would be some value in this child that they had together. However, Yishmael, as the Torah describes, was a para adam. He was a wild donkey. He was a wilderness man. He was an idol worshiper. And usually, you know, my husband always says the personalities start to form it when a child's about 15. That's when you really know when you're what you're in for. Up until then, they're growing and developing. But teenage years are very difficult. And so Sarah knew that this child, this wild child, he was a bad influence. And she did not want her son to grow up with the influence of an older brother. You know, usually a kid looks up to an older brother and you want them to take them on as their role models. But what do you do when your older child or the sibling is difficult? So in this case, she went to Avram and she said, you have to send him away. I can't bring up my Yitzchak in an environment like this. Avraham was the father. It was difficult for him, even though this was a wild child, whatever, it was still his. And then we know that Hashem stepped in, and well, I don't want to say stepped in, but there was Hashem was told Avraham, Shema Bakola. Shema Bakola refers to Nevuah. So, of course, today there is no Nevuah. So I'm just going to call it mother's intuition. And Sarah, as a mother, instinctively knew that she could not allow this child to influence her son. Now, in today's world, we have numerous intrusive influences in our children's lives. Of course, we could go to television, we can go to internet, but I think there's, before all of that, there's their friends. Who are they going to, who are they going away for Shabbos? Who are the parents? Are the parents in the same framework as you are? I remember the ratings on the movies. Some mothers couldn't care less what their kids watch. Other mothers were very careful. And I think that as parents, we have the right to, and then it says, you know, that's your job. You as a parent, your job is to know who your children are friendly with, to try to guide them. You can't say no once they're friends. That's kind of a hard thing to do. You can't pull them away. But I think that it's just important for you to supervise them, to guide them, to make the right decisions. Not every school is right for every child. Not every camp is right for every child. Don't be afraid to think it through and make a change if you need to. Maybe a different school would be better. Maybe you'd have better friends. Maybe this is a better camp for him. You know, don't be negative. Don't tell him his friends are no good. Don't take that approach. You're not going to get anywhere with that. Use good judgment. Supervise, and don't be afraid to say no. sometimes you actually have to say no to a child. I know that's like something in the yeshiva somewhere that got lost somewhere along the line, but no is good. Just don't threaten with your love. Don't take your love away. But be there for him, work with him, nurture him, and make sure you always give him his love. But you got to know who your kid's friends are. And you can have parental guards on your television, on your internet. But you know what? I think it has to be a plan to begin with. Because once it's taken hold, it's very difficult to jump in and try to remove it. So from the beginning, have a plan and think about how you're going to handle things. And it's okay if you make a mistake. We have to make mistakes. There's no other way, but learn from the mistakes and talk to people and help your kid out. Be their protector. I think that's a very important thing, to be there for your kids and raise them with love and kindness and understanding. Okay, anybody? All right, you're all agreeing? No fun. Okay. Next. All right, we'll go on to Rivka. All right, now Rivka had a whole nother set of challenges. First of all, she had twins, and I know we have several sets of twins in the yeshiva, and I don't know, bringing home one baby is hard, bringing home two babies is impossible. However, in Rivka's case, she had an additional burden, because even in utero, while she was carrying these twins, she felt them pulling her from one side to the other. They were running from side to side. In utero, they displayed different personalities. And we know Yaakov was quiet. He was studious. He enjoyed learning. And Esav was physical, and he was wild. And so she's got to now raise two children with two opposing personalities. However, you don't have to have twins to have kids with different personalities. You know, we marry a guy, we probably have different personalities. But when your kid has a different personality, that is an incredible challenge, because it's hard to raise a child that you don't relate to, that you don't really understand. You know, it's nice when they think like you, they act like you, and, you know, and it's kind of easy. But this is just like really a tough situation. I think you have it in your families. Everybody's got the one kid that doesn't seem to belong and throws you a curveball, but you're the mom, and it's your job to try to figure it out and work with him. And you know, physical doesn't mean stupid. So you know, just because one is sitting quietly and reading and the other one is on the ceiling, that does not, I don't think that has anything to do with intelligence. I think that it's an active kid. I mean, I remember when I used to teach, and we'd have all these meetings, and they gave labels to all these children, and I would say, why can't you just say they can't sit on their backsides? I mean, that's what they used to say in the old days, and it was an acceptable fault. Not every kid could sit still, but it doesn't. There's no indication that that is a better child or a worse child. It's an active child with an active mind, with a restless nature, and if you can reach him and you can work with him, and you could let him run around and get him a trampoline and a basketball and whatever it takes, you'll be successful. But if you want cookie-cutter children and you want them all to fall in line and you're not willing to accept that there are differences that you have to work with, you're not going to be successful and you're going to have a very difficult time. I remember when I taught, the one phrase, and I'm sure all you teachers will agree with me, that they constantly said in school is, Chanoch la'na'ar al pi darko. This was every school promised you that they were going to teach your child according to his needs. Well, I'm sorry, ladies, it's not true. They get lumped into a classroom with a hairy teacher. She's got all kinds of personalities, and she has to deal with all of that. And, you know, I remember one time having a kid, I let her sit on top of the bookcase. She couldn't sit in a chair. And my principal came in and he went nuts on me. And then he left and she went back onto the bookcase. You have to like kind of be sympathetic to kids. You know, it isn't easy. I think that people don't understand. It is not easy to be a child. You have your mother telling you what to do. You have your father telling you what to do. You have your teacher telling you what to do. And you feel like you don't get a chance and you have no rights. And children don't have it easy. They have a lot of stuff that they have to deal with. And you as mothers get to know that kid. You know, I think this is what's happening in the pandemic. The kids are not leaving on the bus in the morning and coming back in the afternoon. Now you're starting to see your children. I hope it's not too scary, but I know that it's a long, hard day, and I just got a call from Rachel 3 minutes before I put my thing on. You know what? No one is having an easy time now, not mothers, not fathers, not kids. But in Rivka's case, she was resourceful. Even though Esav was not someone she could relate to, she was very lucky that her husband was able to relate to him. So sometimes you got to divide up the kids, and your husband has to help with the personality that he gets, and you have to deal with the ones that you get. And you know what? Eventually, this kid is going to make you very proud and very happy. He's going to calm down. He's going to get to the books, and he's going to do what he has to. Or he's going to become a millionaire, an entrepreneur, you know. Just, you know, it's a personality. There isn't really a lot that you can do except to work with them, to challenge them. I remember one complaint parents used to come to school and they'd say to me, I don't know, I sit down with my kid, I try to do homework, and I can't. And I think, yeah, you can. And that's why you have to get a tutor. Sometimes you have to have someone else deal with your child. I think a lot of times your mother sees a kid who's not doing well and she thinks, oh, my God, what am I raising, an idiot? I mean, like, whose genes does this kid have? It can't be mine, you know. I remember tutoring a kid and the mother would say, well, you know, I was not a good student, so he's not a good student. So we're always looking, you know, to blame and whatnot. You got to accept, not blame. I hate blame. I don't like blaming anybody for anything. This is your child, whatever. You've got to meet the challenge and do the best you can, whether you've got them both at the same time or a big family and a kid stuck somewhere in the middle who is just not someone you can relate to. It's a challenge. All right? Anybody? No? All right.
Bob, you didn't have to throw me under the bus there.
I didn't say what you said.
Okay, good. Let's keep that between doctor privileges. Come on.
I did not say what you said. Don't be silly.
So, okay. So if I could say, you know, dealing with an 18-year-old girl now who's, I just want to talk about those seniors who are like, woe is me that we have, you know, that they've lost out on so much.
Yeah.
I have to say, parenting is so hard, Herb.
It is.
Like, there's nothing to say, you know.
We have this iron woman who runs a nursing home, and she's complaining about an 18-year-old. Come on. 18-year-old cranks are a lot harder than your daughter, I guarantee.
You're right. You're right. And it's just like biting my tongue and just, you know, in the middle of this, it's
yeah,
very, very
hard. Wait, Sarah, how about sympathizing with her? She worked for 12 years to get to this place.
Right.
And yeah. You know what? There's something about enjoying the culmination and the success, and it got taken away from her. And it might not be in the scheme of things the most important thing in the world, but it is to her, in her world. And so you can't minimize it. You have to realize that you have to, you know, you have to sympathize with her. You do. And, you know, you have to say to her, I understand how hard this must be. My gosh. And you know what? We were talking about weddings and, you know, some of the kids are just going to get married no matter what. And some of the kids want to wait. And someone said to me, I would be devastated if I couldn't make my daughter a wedding. You know, so you've got to realize today people are dealing with very unusual circumstances. And I think not having a graduation is one of them. You know, I mean, personally, I'm glad there was no graduations this year because they are very long and very boring. However, not to the kids. They relish, they relish every, I remember I had three in one year. Oh, you give up. But the kids are very excited about it. So what are you going to do to replace that, Sarah? You're taking her on a trip or?
You do know me well. How do you know me so well? That was the plan. But, you know, the reality is that I think no matter the age of the kids these days, because they're all dealing with different, wherever it is, you know, whether it's my fifth grader not seeing his friends again or.
Right.
It's like it's the all of us like just keeping it quiet, biting our tongue and biding our time. Is
but not the, keeping your mouth closed. Everyone's complaining about eating too much.
Right. So, yeah, it's hard to kick her out. Yeah.
I know. But, you know, why don't you work with her and see how you can compensate?
Right.
You know, see what she would like. She deserves it. Go ahead.
I'm bringing up this as an example for all of us. Like, I think that, you know, and I've been reading everybody's, like, the parenting right now, it's different than ever before, I think.
Yeah, because you're with them all day long.
Unless you're quarantined in your room.
And you're not used to that. That's tough.
Right.
I know. Hopefully it'll be over soon. All right. Let me go on to somebody who I like this one. I like Rachel. I don't know. She's this works for me. All right. Again, Rachel suffered for many years hoping for a child. Finally, she gave birth to Yosef. All right. And I think there's a lot to learn from how she brought him up. And again, this is what I'm extracting, all right? As a young man, we know that Yosef was extremely narcissistic. He couldn't go by the river without gazing at his reflection. He enjoyed his good looks. He was self-centered. He was egotistical. He was a dreamer. And he enraged his siblings to the point that they planned to do away with him. And despite it all, he lives to see his dreams come true. So to me, it's not hard to understand this part of his personality because wouldn't you think that Rachel spoiled him to death? I mean, she waited for him. She wanted him. She had him. It's really hard not to spoil a child like that. And the evidence seems to point to that. Narcissistic, loved himself, thought he was better than his brothers, had these dreams that pointed to his greatness. And yet, you know, we see that he got to the point with his brothers that they wanted to do him in. So I think that spoiling is something that I think it's an issue, you know, and I do believe that every one of us spoils our children on some level. You know, you give in, you give them, you know, it's easier to give in sometimes. You buy the present, you want them to be happy, you don't want to fight with them. And the problem is when spoiling replaces your love and when it's not used to address underlying issues, you just throw more things at him. Hopefully the problem will go away. And it's easier to give in and than to fight, but there's no gain in that. When spoiling is done in a way that shows the mother's love, then there's a huge gain and the child becomes confident. So there's a fine line between spoiling them to just shut them up and get them out of your way and give them stuff, and spoiling them in a way that gives them confidence and love. And I think that's exactly what happened here with Rachel. She had to spoil him. I can't imagine any other way. But she spoiled him up to a point. And I can say that because despite his early beginning and despite his narcissistic personality and despite his love of himself and his taunting of his brothers, when it was time for him to lead and become Yosef in Mitzrayim and deal with Paro and ministers and supply chains and economics, etc., he was able to stand up to the job. So I don't think that someone who's very spoiled or spoiled beyond would ever be able to get that part of his personality going, that of being a strong, viable, productive person. So I think that Rachel must have known how to strike a balance and bring up probably a perfect child. I mean, I think he accomplished a great deal. So spoiling is another, it's easy. I think it's easier sometimes to spoil a child than sit down and talk to them and spend time with them. Things replace the mother, and I think that's kind of sad. So give them what they need. I remember I struggled with, you know, even when Rav Pesach was growing up, it was in somewhat of a, his friends were the affluent ones, and they were always getting stuff, and it was very hard. And I said to my husband, well, what am I supposed to do? And he said, just don't make him feel different. Give him, I remember Atari, that was the big thing. Atari, it was $125 and it was like, ay, ay, ay. But you know what? That was something that he needed, and he could be part of, you know, the group. And so we made a choice, and we just didn't want him to feel different. So depriving a child is terrible, because then he's different. If, you know, he wants to look like his friends or this is the current thing, fine. Because if he doesn't have confidence in himself, then he's going to have a hard time in life. So that was Rachel, the mother who knew how to strike a balance between spoiling her child and not. Okay? Anybody? Okay. What?
I said it gives me a little hope. Definitely into spoiling these days, so no, it's not necessarily.
It's why I don't know who would. I don't know who's talking.
Esty,
like.
Esty.
Okay.
And my bird. Yeah.
Oh, Esty and the bird.
Yeah, I was just saying it's good because, you know, I definitely find myself falling more towards the spoiling side these days. You know, but it's just good to know that that's not necessarily like a bad lot.
No, because first of all, you get grown up, so they're already developed. You know, that's another important point I think that I would like to share with you. Like, you know, I see this, you know, the children are raised and then they become adults. And then the parents want a second shot at raising them again. That's not going to happen. You put in your parenting skills, you do the best you can. And then when they're grown up and they become adults, you look at them and you say, oy, you know what, I'm not happy about this and maybe I could change that. You can't. You can't. You did yours. And I think, Essie, at this point, you know, if you spoil the kids, it's indulging. I don't think it's spoiling. I think there's a difference, you know, because I think spoiling sends a message that it's not the mommy, but it's the stuff. You know, the stuff takes over, and they really want the mommy. So if you indulge them, you're a good mommy, I think. You know, why not?
You're good. Well, it works for me.
We all like a little indulgence, especially now.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
how do you give kids things without giving them a sense of entitlement to having the things?
Well, first of all, I think that it's, you know, it's kind of fun to give your kids things, you know, Bubby. I like to make my kids happy and I like to give them things, but I don't think that I would give you everything and not my love. I give hugs and kisses and chocolates and whatever is age appropriate. I don't think that's it's interesting, that word entitlement. Like, how do you mean it? Like,
I don't know, like always expecting things from the parent and like expecting that they have a right to get extra things, or like if everybody has this thing, then they have a right to have it too.
But what gives you that right? I mean, in other words, you're a child and you want to have things, you want to be like everybody else. And, you know, it's something, I guess parents depend, if they're in tune with their kids, I guess they will be able to discern what's most important to the child. I think that's an essential in parenting, that you have to really understand your child. Every child in the family has different needs, and there are different things that are important to each child. And I know that, you know, I mean, it sounds like a challenge, but I think if you're raising these children, then you should know your children. You should know what's important, and you should be able to, I mean, you know, like I know in your family, every kid is different and has different things that are important for them to have. And I think that that's the way you should deal with it. Don't lump them all in together.
All right.
Okay. So now I'm down to the last mom. I mean, I could have chosen others and I could briefly go through them, but this one is a scary one to me. This is like mother, like daughter. And that's kind of an interesting one. So we're talking about Leia. All right. Now, it's interesting. Leah has an encounter with Rachel over the Dudaim, the ferns that Reuven collected. And when the conflict is over, so Leah gets to have Yaakov for the night. And the pasuk says, Vateitzei Leah likrosel. She went out in the field to meet Yaakov so that he would know that it was her night. Now, she was married to him, and, you know, there was nothing wrong with her telling him that this was the case, but she was criticized. And the Rashi says, Al shem yitziyosa, atetze leo likroso, al shem yitziyosa, that Leah went out, and it was the manner in which she went that was criticized. She went out towards him in a bold manner. She was, I'll say bold. She went out towards him and she was bold. And Rashi or the Mefarshim say, it's not what she did. She had the right to go towards him. She was married to him. But it was how she did it that she was criticized for. Her going out to him did not have the character of a tsnua. And I am not going to go into sleeves and lengths and stuff. I'm referring to the nature of the woman. Because tsnius is something that is strictly feminine, that belongs solely to a woman. It's an expression of her fineness, her gentility, her humility. And that was what was lacking when she went out in a bold manner towards Yaakov. Then we find that her daughter Dinah, it says in the Torah that Vateitzei Dinah bas Leah, that Dinah, the daughter of Leah, went out. So naturally the question is, why do we put the two names together? So Rashi says, Avhi Yotzanis Haisa. She was just like her mother. She went out as a young woman in a strange town all by herself. She was bold. It was inappropriate. It was the wrong message that she was sending. Can you imagine a young woman going out alone in a strange town, unescorted, and the guys there, they're not going to approach her as a sophisticated woman or a woman of stature. They're going to go after her, which is what eventually that they did. And so just like her mother, she too displayed a lack of sneers. It was the way that she went out that was so inappropriate. So again, it wasn't what she did, but how she did it. And here's a lesson for all of us, and that is that as a mother, it's very important how you act, because how you act really affects the growth of your child. You know, I know many times you have a friend over and you're talking and all of a sudden you have this kid sitting there absorbing every word. They hear everything that you're saying. Well, not only do they hear everything you're saying, but they observe everything you're doing. You can't fool them. They live with you. They're in the house and they kind of get you. So it's vitally important to remember that. It's you're teaching them by example. You cannot teach a child by lecturing. You can't harp on things. The best teacher is you and your manner, your deportment, the way you act. When I would teach, parents would come to me and they say to me, "Oh, I thought you were going to teach my kids to be respectful." And I would look at them and I say, "Excuse me, I have your kid 40 minutes a day, four times a week. That's not my job. That's your job. You're the one who's supposed to teach this to your children." I believe learning starts at home. They watch you. They learn from you. You do it with joy. You do it with a hislavas. You're excited. Shabbos, yantiv, getting preparations, buying them clothing, giving stuff up. I mean, I remember my mother would literally, I mean, it was a totally different world. My mother would package things to bring to people and leave on their doorsteps. And my mother took me along. And she'd always say to me, "You know, yeah, this is, they need it. I'm giving it." My mother would give me, my tuition was $12 a month. And my mother would give me the envelope with the $12 in it. She'd say to me, "Schar limud. You have to know there's such a thing as schar limud. You have to pay for a Torah education." I learned a lot of things, and my mother was not an educated woman. She did not go to yeshiva. But she approached life and Torah and mitzvot and chesed. My mother would send packages to Israel constantly from her own money. And she was not making a lot of money. But she was that way. My grandmother believed that it was the biggest mitzvah to be part of the Chevra Kedisha. And these are things, my grandmother went to shul early in the morning. I mean, I was brought up with a certain sense of, this is what you give to a child. This is how you bring them up. You know, spend a little time and take them to shul. It's terrible that young women are not going to shul today. They're home in the morning. They're in their pajamas. It's Shabbos. They're vegging out. Too bad. Too bad. I think children should come to shul. I think they should be dressed for Shabbos. They should be appropriate. They should understand how fortunate they are to be part of a community. This is part of their education. I think that, to me, you can't replace that. This is vital to be a mother who guides her children by example. And then I just want to say that even though I say sneers is humility and how we conduct ourselves and all of that, I just want you to know that anytime a woman has to step up to the plate and has to do something that is counterintuitive to being a tsnua, she has to do it. And I think the best example is Yael and Sisera. Could you imagine what that woman did? A little wine, a little cheese, a little sleep, and a nail in his head. So, but that doesn't take away from her being a tsnua, because that was something that was necessary. She rose to the occasion. And yeah, she used force and she used aggression, but she was still a tsnua. There was a purpose. All right, so I just one more thing to say, and I want to thank my friend Toby Wolf for this, because we both actually giving classes today, both on women. She's taken a totally different route than me, but that's the way it goes. But in any event, she said that this is a perfect ending, and it comes from Megillas Rus. So of course it ties into Shavuos. So in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Yud Aleph, it says, "Vayomu kol ha'am asher b'sha'ar v'hazkenim, edim yiten Hashem es ha'isha haba'a el beisecha Kerachel Ukaleya, Asher Banu Shteim Espace Yisrael. So this is really talking about when Ruth was going to marry Boaz, and the blessing to her was that she should be like Rachel and Leah, who both were builders of Klal Yisrael. So here we learn something that's kind of interesting, and that is there's another element to being an Ein B'Yisrael, and that is sometimes you have to be willing to sacrifice your own life for your offspring, your children. Ruth married Boaz. He was a very old man. It was not a romantic relationship. It was not even a love relationship. And I think Chazal say he died the next day. But the point of it is she sacrificed her own personal happiness in order to help to build Klal Yisrael. And Rachel and Leah also suffered in order to build Klal Yisrael. Rachel died on the way after the incident with Esav, and she was buried on the road. She was not buried at the Ma'os HaMachpelah with the other Imahos. But she did, in fact, it says, Rachel Mevake Al Baneha, she was there for her children when they rode back and forth to pray to her and rely on her inspiration. And Leah, of course, we know, had a loveless marriage, and she did it to build Shiftei Kah. So that's the ultimate sacrifice, and I hope that you got something from tonight and you enjoyed it. Anybody want to comment or share anything, or you just, okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anne, did you want to say something? Hello? Okay. So I wish you all
here. I was just telling my teenager to do something.
Okay. You have that right. You are the mother.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, you better mute then if you're going to be hollering at your kids then after all of this. Okay.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a very good Yantif and love your kids.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Have a good Yantif, everybody.
Bye-bye.